Hi, I'm Sarah Gardner, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of June 21st, 2013. Now that summer's here and the weather is heating up, so are things at the Federal Reserve in Washington. Now, don't nod off just because I said those two sleep-inducing words, Federal Reserve. I know, the Fed is boring, but it also happens to affect just about everything in our personal financial lives. That's because what goes on at the Fed doesn't stay at the Fed. It controls interest rates, and that, of course, affects how much we pay for things. Everybody was a Twitter about what Chairman Ben Bernanke would say at this month's meeting. But to most of us, it sounded a bit like this. Yeah. So what do we know? Well, we don't need Mr. Bernanke to tell us that interest rates are going up. The average 30-year mortgage rate is now around 4%. That's up from 3.25% just a few months ago. And with the economy getting stronger, interest rates are likely to keep rising. Elise Glink is a personal finance journalist and author. She's here to explain what it all means for your personal finances. Elise, thanks for joining us.
It's nice to be here, Sarah.
So all this hullabaloo over what Ben Bernanke said this week, what he didn't say, can we just all assume that interest rates are going to go up from this point forward?
You know, I don't think it's a straight line, but I do think they're going to go up.
Why are they going to go up?
Because simply you can't stay where we are now. We're buying our way into this rate, right? The Fed has been pouring money to the tune of $85 billion a month into the markets to artificially depress these interest rates, and they're doing it to try and stimulate the economy. The only reason we're here with these interest rates, which again have been at historic lows, is simply a reflection of how awful our economy has been and still is for the larger general public. Once the economy starts to get better, there won't be a need for us to be here.
Yeah. Well, let's break it down, Elise, because interest rates going up can be a good thing for some and a bad thing for others, right? First of all, who wins as rates go up?
Well, the only people that win might be the entire senior population and anybody who lives off of fixed income securities.
Right.
You know, they've been living off of zero, and that's really a hard place. And they're eating into all of their capital, which is nothing that they prepared for. And it's going to cause some very serious problems for the rest of us down the line when they run out of money altogether. So they're going to win, if win is the term you want to use. The somewhat losers, and if it's not even really true, but the somewhat losers are people who have been buying property or wanted to buy at rock bottom interest rates, because it allows them to basically buy more house for the money. And that, in conjunction with still depressed housing prices, means that even though they've gone up a little bit, we saw that number rise again this week, it still means its affordability is at an all-time high. So the thinking is that mortgage interest rates can go up to even 5 or 5.5% for a 30-year fixed rate loan before the housing market starts to get into trouble. I don't know if that's true, because there's a psychological thing going on here, but it might be.
Listen, we have had a lot of questions from listeners this week, some of whom are looking to refinance their mortgages. They seem to be in a rush to lock in their refis, you know, worried that interest rates are going to go up really, really fast. Should they be pushing the panic button, or do they have a lot of time?
I don't know what lot of time means, but there's no need to panic. We're not going to see mortgage interest rates jump to 11% by December.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen. We're not even going to see them go up, I don't think, to 5%. Again, because the Fed is pushing hard and buying it down. What you saw happen over the last couple of weeks is that investors are starting to feel like maybe there's some other opportunities around the world, and they're pulling money out of the market. And by necessity, supply and demand, that means that we're going to see interest rates rise a little bit. And that is what has happened.
Yeah. And of course, this affects borrowers in general, not just people who are looking to buy homes, right? This is going to affect credit card rates, auto loans.
Right. It affects everybody across the board. It also makes it a little bit more difficult for people who are borrowing money for businesses, right? They're buying, basically, they're borrowing money and getting loans so they can invest in their business, and it's going to get a little bit more expensive. But anybody, for buying a house, if you think that it's suddenly unaffordable because it's 0.5% higher, that means you're spending too much for the house. Go buy a cheaper house.
Yeah. Now, the stock market this week didn't react very well to all this now that it's clear that the Fed's going to wind down this economic stimulus program. Is that just, in your mind, a short-term market reaction, or might there be some longer-term implications for stock prices as interest rates go up?
You know, the stock market and interest rates typically move in inverse directions. So as the Fed has been buying down these rates and pushing them down, we've seen the stock market bounce back from its low. Remember how low it really was. It was like at 7,000 in 2009. Now we're at, you know, flirting with 15,000 above and a little below. That is a huge comeback entirely driven by interest rates. So the thinking there is, right, companies spend less with their interest rates to borrow, and so they're going to invest in the business. It's going to be cheaper. The profits are going to be bigger. And we have seen some of that happen.
Right.
And so the stock market's gone up. When interest rates rise, the stock market should go down. And I say should because nothing's ever certain.
Right. But no reason to pull out of the stock market at this point.
I think that would be an overreaction. If you really are trying to time the market, and I'm going to be the first to say that never works, you just get lucky or you don't. But if you really want to try and time the market, just take a piece of your investments off the table. Don't take everything off the table.
Elise Glink is a personal finance journalist and author. Elise, thanks so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks.
It's official. It's summertime, my friends. Time to read a good book, laze around at the beach, sleep in. You wish. If you're a working parent and you haven't figured out how to keep your kids occupied with some life-enriching, brain-expanding activity this summer, you're late. Even picking a summer camp for your kid isn't simple anymore. Peg Smith knows all things summer camp. She's CEO of the American Camp Association. Peg, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
You know, when I think of camp, what I think of is, you know, leaky tents, mosquitoes, and s'mores. Is that the kind of summer camp that most kids are attending nowadays?
Well, I will tell you, you can still find that camp.
Yeah.
But what you'll find today is a great diversification in today's camp community. So it goes really from a very traditional camp where you may, in fact, have tents to very high-end camps and also specialty camps and a blend of those in between. We say that there's a camp for every interest, every child, and every budget.
I was on your website, and I must admit, I was a little shocked at how expensive some of these camps can get. I mean, I think 1 week could cost you anywhere from $500 to $2,000, 4 weeks, $1,700. To $7,000. Can it really get that expensive?
It can. But when you're looking at cost, you have flexible sessions. You can look at discounts that are available, sliding fee scales. So I always say to people, don't be alarmed until you really do your homework.
Well, let's talk about that, because a lot of people who don't have the means would like to be able to send their kids to a really good camp. And we can be talking, you know, a couple thousand dollars. Are there hidden deals out there that they don't know about? I mean, how can they afford those?
We tend to think that a quality camp is only demonstrated by the cost. I just want to caution that parents not judge the quality of a camp simply on the cost of the camp. Quality has to do with health and safety. Quality has to do with facility. Quality also has to do with the staff training, staff ratios, the kind of programming, whether they have trained their staff, et cetera. So you do your homework. And I always say one of the best ways to do it is go to campparents.org. It really gives the parents the list of questions they need to ask and the things they should look for.
So how common is it, Peg, though, that some of these pricier camps would give out a scholarship or go by sliding fee?
It is common. And I will tell you that within just the ACA camp community alone, on an annual basis, there are $216 million worth of scholarships that are given out to kids so that they're able to go to camp.
Really?
And then on top of that, there are discounts that you may get for early registration. There are some camps that give discounts for multiple enrollments. So if you have siblings that are wanting to go, you can often get a discount. You can talk to the camp director and simply ask, what's available? What discounts do you have? Do you do a sliding fee scale? Do you offer scholarships? What can you do that would help me manage this? Because I think this is an important experience for my child.
Yeah, so go straight to the director.
Absolutely.
I want to ask you, if most kids are like my 16-year-old, they are glued to their electronic devices. Do you see,
yes,
Peg, that camps are sort of going with the trend here and letting kids bring their iPads and cell phones with them? Or is there a trend in camps now to make these sort of cell phone tablet free?
Well, 75% of the camps that we deal with are still electronic free. You know, what's interesting, and I found this also with my own boys, the parents have a harder time disconnecting than the kids. You know, the camp environment is set up to keep me busy as a camper and to keep me active and engaged. And so I quickly am sort of disengaged and unplugged and very comfortable. It's really the parents that are left behind that are often
right,
having greater struggles. I certainly did. And my son, I thought for sure he would never be able to unplug, because they say today kids spend more than 7 hours in front of a screen. But that's also why I say today this experience is probably more important than it ever has been in its history. It connects you to nature. It allows you to have authentic relationships. And it's also human-powered.
Peg Smith is CEO of the American Camp Association. Peg, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you.
First weekend of summer, so we thought we'd talk to a few of our listeners about what's making them hot, hot under the collar, that is. And it turns out a lot of you are ticked off, annoyed, or cheesed off, as our producer likes to say, about questionable customer relations at companies you deal with. So we have invited our favorite consumer rights crusader to weigh in on what to do when you're getting the runaround. Los Angeles Times consumer columnist David Lazarus is here. Thanks for being here, David.
Well, thanks for having me back.
Now, before we get to the consumer complaints, we just heard all about summer camp, and I have to know, David, summer camp an essential childhood experience or not? What do you think?
I'm the father of an 11-year-old boy, so I've looked at this. He's in camp right now. And we looked at all the options, everything from sleepaway camp to some of the pricier day camps to
right,
some of the less pricey ones. And in our case, what we were looking for was just some flexibility in terms of the activities he'd like, for instance,
right,
basketball, soccer, and that sort of thing. And then maybe we could ice the cake with some actual learning, which would be good. you never know. But the costs are astronomical
yeah,
for this sort of thing. Hundreds of dollars a week.
Right.
And what we ended up doing is we went to our local Parks and Rec and
perfect,
found that the nearby park and rec to our house, the center there, has a day camp where kids can come by in the morning. They do activities. They get picked up in the afternoon. They're around their peers. It's fun. And we went down that road primarily because the idea was just to get them out of the house.
Right,
get out there, And if we can't get them a factory job, then this would be sufficient.
Right. That is the word from David Lazarus. Summer camp, yes, but affordable summer camp.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got some callers waiting. Our first caller is Moyo Sore in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Moyo Sore, welcome to Marketplace Money.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us, what's up? You have a complaint about your cable company?
That's correct. In February last year, 2012, I called my cable company to alert them that in 2 weeks I will be moving from that address.
Okay.
And I gave them 3 weeks' notice to, after 3 weeks, disconnect the line and close my account, because where I'm moving to, I will not need a cable network.
Okay.
So the lady on the other side of the line took notes, took my name, everything, and said, fine, it's all done. 3 months later, I got a letter asking me for a balance of $52. And I said, what for? I've always paid in advance, up front.
Right.
So, and I gave you notice before I moved, so I'm not owing you. He said, well, no one could explain to me for what that amount is. Anyway, I ignored the letters. Later on, a collection agency got involved, started to harass me with letters and phone calls.
Right.
And I just conferred with a banker friend of mine who advised that, well, if you don't pay up, these people will report me to the credit agencies and it will hurt my credit rating.
Yeah.
I have a second thought, and so I sent $20 check to them. That's it. So they started calling again and writing letters, which I ignored, until about a month ago, a different collection agency started even more strongly worded letter for the balance of $32.
Yeah.
In my mind, I do not owe them. I don't see why I should pay.
Right.
And in fact, in the last letter I got, I don't even know how much I'm owing now, because in the letter it reads, because of interest, late charges, and other charges that may vary from day to day, the amount due on the day you pay may be greater. Hence, if you pay the amount shown above, an adjustment may be necessary after we receive your check. So I don't know whether it's $32 now or even more.
Yeah. So we're really all of this over a $52 bill that you don't think you owe. David, does he have any recourse here? What can he do?
Yeah, he does have recourse. There's a couple of moving parts to this, so let's unpack it. First of all, let's look at the debt collection, because I want to get to the cable company in a moment. The debt collector has been brought into the picture because the cable company passed off the bill to these guys, and they don't care. These guys are bottom feeders. They're going after whatever they can get. Federal law says a debt collector cannot harass people. So that's the first thing. If they're calling at all hours, if they're being in any way abusive on the telephone, you call them on that. You report them to the Federal Trade Commission, because a consumer does have rights here. Now, all of these debt collectors, by law, have to have a dispute resolution process. You contact them, you go to their website, you find out how you can challenge a debt. You're going to have to submit something in writing saying this isn't correct for X, Y, and Z reasons. Moreover, a debt collector, by law, has to show you in writing what you owe. So call them on it and make them have to do that. That's the first thing. Second thing is the cable company. To me, this all begins and ends with those guys. Now, if the caller indeed acted in good faith, called and gave notice that he was going to be closing down his service, that's all good. And as he said, they took notes. So there should be a paper trail here.
Yeah.
So you call back to the cable company, immediately kick it up to the supervisor level. The first line of defense, they can't help you at all. Ask for a supervisor. Supervisor comps on, looks at your file, first confirm that there is some sort of record that you did try to terminate, and then once they acknowledge that, make them explain what that $50 charge is.
Yeah. Moyosori, have you tried calling the cable company and, you know, trying to kick it upstairs, as David says?
Yes, at the beginning, I did try that, and I didn't get too far.
Yeah.
And I just gave up on it.
No, don't give up. This is a classic example of the squeaky wheel getting all the attention. So you've got to stick with it, because if you don't, nobody else will. Moreover, the only thing that's going to get these debt collectors off your back is the cable company calling them off, not you saying, oh, come on, mea culpa, it's not my fault. Right. That won't help. So the cable company has to be your first and last stop here, because they're the ones who are going to get you out of this. You've got to get them to acknowledge that you tried to give notice. You've got to get them to tell you reasonably what that $50 charges for, and then you work out whether you do indeed owe, and you might. I mean, there might be some outstanding charge for HBO or, you know, something else. Who knows?
Right.
But they have an obligation to explain it and to, if you require it, to put it on paper.
But David, your point is, it's worth it to put in all this effort, because actually his credit rating is at risk if he doesn't get this resolved, right?
Well, he and all others who have debt collectors baying at their heels face just that, because their leverage here is to thrash your credit score. Nobody wants that. I mean, yeah, they can try and sue you. They're probably not. Remember, these guys are going for pennies on the dollar, but they can do damage. Moreover, if they do go after your credit score, it can take you years to get that repaired. It's just not worth going down that road. It's a drag that consumers have to jump through all these hoops, but this is the reality of it, and you got to do it.
Yeah. Moyosore, are you ready to do battle?
I don't know. At this stage, I think I committed myself by paying $20 some time ago, and it appears as if I don't feel I'm obliged to. Why did I pay that amount? So I feel that maybe I have to just resolve it.
Now, stick with it. And if you're in the right here, that $20 will come back to you, because you'll tell the cable company, pay up. It's not fair. If you have reasonable grounds here, at some point you will prevail. Let's face it, the corporate powers that be are hoping that disgruntled consumers will just go away. You don't have any other protection except your own outrage and indignation, and use those as weapons.
Okay.
Thank you so much, and good luck in getting your problem resolved.
Thank you for having me. Keep up the good work, guys.
David, we've got some more callers on the line. I hope you could stick around.
Our consumer gripe cup runneth over, huh?
David Lazarus is with me in the studio today. He's the consumer columnist at the Los Angeles Times, and he's answering questions from our listeners about personal finance problems. Let's go to our next caller, Kate, in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Kate, thanks for being here.
Hi, guys. It's great to be with you.
We understand you are getting the runaround from your health insurance company over some pretty big medical bills. Tell us what's happening.
Yeah, I am. And it seems like I've been fighting the good fight, as you've just advised your previous caller. And let me tell you, it takes a lot of energy to do that. So basically, about a year and a half ago, I had a first-time injury of sciatica. And I acted within good faith. I had insurance.
Right.
I went to an in-network doctor who sent me to an in-network physical therapist, and I stayed within my bounds of the number of visits I was allowed to have per my benefits. I paid my copays, thought it was good. And a few months later, I start getting letters from my insurance company. And basically, the quick way to summarize their behavior in my mind is that they're playing a shell game.
Okay.
And so the insurance company kept giving me different excuses over the past year as to why they were not paying certain visits. A lot of the excuses were they automatically said, this is a pre-existing condition.
The sciatica.
But of course, we didn't have insurance the year before I got injured. So we were under that 1 year, every time you go to a doctor, you have to send the insurance company a form saying, no, it wasn't pre-existing, and the doctor has to do the same. So for all of those visits, there had to be a lot of paper flying back and forth between me and the doctor and the insurance company. But
Kate,
we did it.
Let me interrupt you for just one quick sec. When you became insured again, did you have the sciatica already there, or did it come after you became reinsured?
No, it came 5 months after.
Okay, so in no way was this a pre-existing condition, is what you're telling me.
Not at all.
Okay, go on, please.
So first they were telling me that this was pre-existing. I fought that, and my doctors fought that, and we took it to not just the people you call on the phone with the insurance company, but then to their rapid resolution department, which is quite an interesting name given that it's been a year. And I did a couple of on-paper documenting and appeals to them. And then they started paying for some and not for others, and then the excuse switched to the doctor was not in network, and it just kept switching reasons why they were paying for some and weren't paying for others, and it got to be very confusing.
So at this point, where are you with your bills?
So it got sent to collections, which I've been trying to rebuild my credit for the past couple of years. That was always my goal, for it to not get there. I did dispute it in writing with the collections agency, as you suggested to the previous caller. I said, hey, heads up, I'm you know, I should not have to pay this. And the collections agency said, okay, well, we're not going to report it to the credit bureaus for 90 days. So we've got your dispute, and you've got 90 days to duke it out with your insurance company.
Yeah.
And I was still duking it out by day 80, so I just paid the debt collectors because I didn't want to go and affect my credit. But I have one of these credit alert things, and I got an email saying my credit dropped, my credit score. And I was like, uh-oh. So I called the debt collector, and sure enough, they had sent it before the 90 days to the credit agencies. So they said, well, we sent a letter, you know, to all three saying, oops, and, you know, but it could take 90 days. And in the meantime, you need to go to each of the three credit bureaus and chart a dispute with them, a register of dispute. So that happened on the on my credit score front, and on the insurance company front, they've sort of fixed some of their error. They had made all pretty much most of the mistakes. But then in doing that, they've gone back and saying, oh, well, now this other eye doctor visit that you had, we had applied your money to that. So now you owe for that. And so the shell game kind of continues with them. And we pay 33% more than our mortgage every month for our health insurance. And so I feel really trapped. It's not like it's some company like my phone company that I could drop and pick up something else. So it's very frustrating.
David, why don't you jump in here? This is fairly common, isn't it, that you see insurers arguing about pre-existing conditions?
All too common, and it's no wonder that medical problems are one of the leading causes of bankruptcy in this country because you can so quickly get in over your head.
But it's going to her credit.
I know.
To her credit.
This is a whole comedy of errors that, and I don't mean to make light, Kate, but it so quickly got out of control for no good reason and certainly, apparently, through no fault of your own, which is what makes this so exasperating.
Right. David, it sounds, though, like Kate has been doing what she needs to do. She's been going back to the doctors.
Every
step of the way. She's been getting paperwork. So at this point, what can she do? I mean, she's got to save her credit rating.
Right.
What can she do at
this
point?
She's got two roads to travel. Right now, she has to square things with the health insurer. Even though she paid off those debts, that's not good enough. She in no way wants her insurance record to reflect the fact that there was a mistake, because you never know if that's going to come back and bite you in the long run. Like, for instance, she has to see the same doctor again, and once again they say, oh, well, he's out of network because he was out of network the last time. Well, but no, he wasn't. So Kate has to go back and make sure that all of those I's are dotted and T's are crossed in terms of where the network is, what's a pre-existing condition, what isn't. Make sure that they acknowledge every step of the way that this is how it is. And then get their help in squaring things with the debt collectors, because that's their fault. And the credit agencies are such a hassle. Each one of them has their own dispute resolution process. None of them are friendly. None of them are easy. And it's a pain, but I'll tell you, Kate, you got to do it. And I hate to sound like a broken record, but every time these guys inflict this level of pain on a consumer, the onus is on you to dig your way out or have these things come back and haunt you later.
Yeah. Kate, now, and I understand that you even got so frustrated with your insurer that you did not use insurance for your pregnancy.
Yeah. While this was all going on, I got pregnant, had a pregnancy, and delivered a baby, and she's 6 months old.
Well, that's expensive. What are you, Marcus Welby? I mean, how do you do that? We're talking thousands and thousands of dollars there.
Well, luckily I'm healthy, and I went to a midwife and a birth clinic, and it cost me about 3 months of my health insurance premium to pay for my birth.
Yeah.
Even though it all worked out well and sounds very holistic and nice, the reality is Kate shouldn't have been denied access to equitable health care if she had wanted it, simply because of all of these other issues. Here's another tip for you, Kate. Go on to Google and do a search for patient advocates in your area. There are such critters. It can cost you a little bit of money sometimes, sometimes not. But a patient advocate is somebody who knows the system. Oftentimes, they're a former hospital worker or a former insurance worker. They know the landscape. They know the people you need to contact. And they can midwife you through this process.
Very good. Okay, Kate, we wish you the best. Let us know what happens, okay?
Hey, I might become a patient advocate.
There you go.
There you go. Okay. And if you're like Kate, you're a fan of Marketplace Money on Facebook. Thanks for that. We love hearing from our listeners on social media, and we're on Twitter at Radio Piggy Bank. Or you can always send us an old-fashioned email by visiting marketplacemoney.org. David Lazarus is our guest this hour, and we're talking to some frustrated consumers about their negative experiences with companies.
Why aren't they ever positive? Why don't people call? I just want to let you know how good this company is. I don't get enough of those letters.
David, you have talked about trip insurance before on this program, and today we have a caller who opted not to use trip insurance for an overseas vacation, and he's getting the runaround. It's John from Mason, Ohio. Hi, John.
Hello.
Hi. So tell us about this trip you were planning and what happened.
Okay. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
We were trying to take a trip to Europe last June, actually. I bought the tickets through airfare.com on Continental.
Okay.
Didn't get the travel insurance, as you mentioned. The problem, however, actually started when I had outpatient surgery done before the trip. The trip was timed so it wouldn't have any problems with, you know, the after effects of surgery or anything, but literally the day before we were supposed to leave, the doctor said words to the effect that, I hope we could take care of this complication here in the office, but you're going to have to cancel your trip and have outpatient surgery on Monday. So that was the first problem. I called airfare.com. They said, well, we can't do a refund, but we can reschedule the flight if it's the exact same route.
Okay.
And you pay the change fee. So I did that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it was with Continental. In the meanwhile, Continental got bought by United. And then airfare.com told me the flight confirmation number was changed by the Continental merger. The reservation can't go through the prior agency. You have to go directly through United. So then I called United, and at first they sort of fumbled around, but then they said, yeah, they had the information to rebook any time before the 19th of June. I was reassured there'd be no problem. Then last week when I tried to actually rebook the flight, the regular booking desk, which is where I had called before, said they didn't have the fair amount, but I might be able to rebook through the executive account desk.
My eyes are crossing already. So you've made about 25 phone calls in the last couple of weeks, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Listening to that whole problem, it reminded me of the game of Mousetrap, where you're moving around the board and all those scary things are happening.
Yeah.
Right.
To me, the central issue here was the United buyout of Continental. When you try to merge these computer systems together, all heck breaks loose. And that is one of the problems with big mergers, because consumers can easily fall through the crack. By my reckoning here, what happened is the computer erased for some reason the value of John's ticket. So even though it acknowledged that he bought a ticket,
right,
even though it acknowledged that he paid his rescheduling fee and did all that stuff, by not having the value of the ticket in the system, it threw a monkey into the wrench for all the subsequent things he needed to do,
right,
because there was no credit,
right,
available to him. All right, John, you're going to have to backtrack and refly these unfriendly skies with the airline. And if you can't get satisfaction from customer service, what I advise you to do is put this all in writing politely, because politely is important, and send either an email or a registered letter to the CEO's office. Hmm. The CEO of virtually every company, but I can guarantee it for the airlines, has a dispute resolution team. This is kind of a little secret that I can share with people. And that dispute resolution team trumps all the other ones because they report to the big boss. And so your letter or email goes there. The CEO's office hands it to their team and says, fix this. And then suddenly you have a whole different breed of consumer service rep dealing with your problem. And point out to them in your letter what you think the theory is that as a result of the computer systems coming together, apparently the value of your ticket got wiped out, thus causing this cascade of problems. Something tells me that if you're polite about it and remind them that they don't want to lose a customer in good standing to the two or three other airlines that now exist in the world, then they're going to want to work with you.
John, does that help at all?
Yeah, I'll try that, see what they say.
Yeah, good luck, and we hope you do get to Europe at some point.
Yeah, and send us a postcard.
Yeah, thank you.
David, our time's up. It's been a pleasure. David Lazarus, consumer columnist at the LA Times. Thanks for all your good advice.
Oy vey.
What do Atlantic Records, The New Yorker, and Fox Searchlight Pictures have in common? Well, they've all been accused of exploiting unpaid interns. There's been a rash of lawsuits in the past couple months, and the charges are pretty much the same. Interns working overtime, doing menial tasks like making coffee, organizing cabinets, running errands for creative types. Not exactly the kind of vocational training that internships are supposed to be about. Almost a third of college students take unpaid internships now, but it's not always clear how to get something meaningful out of the experience. That's something Lauren Berger knows a thing or two about. She's author of the book All Work, No Pay, and she writes the blog Intern Queen. She's also completed more than a dozen internships herself. Lauren Berger, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Talk to us about internships before you take one. What do you need to know before saying, yes, I'll do it?
Well, if you're a student, you really want to look for a structured internship program. You want to know that you're going into a situation where they have the benefit of the intern top of mind.
Right.
So when you're in an interview for an internship, a great question to ask is, can you describe a day as an intern at your company? And this is really going to show you if the employer is really aware of what the interns are doing. And if they're not aware, it's not a good sign.
Right. Do you need to know anything about the law? I mean, should you know anything legal before you go into it?
Right. So my message as sort of the intern queen is always be proactive, take initiative, and know your rights as an intern. Know what's allowed and what's not allowed, because you have to be your own advocate. If you look up the Fair Labor Standards Act, the FLSA, they have a fact sheet, and it's sort of a test. So an unpaid internship can be an unpaid internship,
right,
as long as they meet these six criteria that the Fair Labor Standards Act describes.
So, Lauren, can you name a few of the rules under the Fair Labor Standards Act?
Sure. The interns should not be doing revenue-generating activities. They shouldn't displace regular paid employees.
Okay.
Anything done at the internship should be in the benefit of the student. It also states that the interns really need to have a structured, supervised learning experience. This is an educational experience.
So, Lauren, what should you do if you feel like you are being exploited as an intern?
This goes for paid interns and unpaid interns. If you feel like there's a problem, you need to stand up and you have to have a conversation. Now, my advice to a student would be the first conversation is either with your internship coordinator or the HR rep at the company that hired you. If for some reason you don't feel comfortable talking to those people, the best person to talk with is going to be your university's career center. Their job is to make sure that you're comfortable at your internship, and they will have the conversations that you don't want to have. But make sure you have a conversation because, you know, we're seeing with a lot of these lawsuits, some of these people were interning in 2007. You know, it's 2013 now. That was a long time ago. And I have to look at those cases and say, what if the student said something? If they said something, would it be any different? And we don't know the answer to that. But again, if you see something, you have a dialogue because it can be fixed in a lot of cases.
What was your worst internship?
You know, I didn't have a worst company that I interned for. I had a lot of embarrassing moments as an intern. It's funny because a lot of people say, oh, interns shouldn't have to make coffee. That's terrible. If you work in an office environment, you need to know how to make coffee. When I was a junior in college, I had no idea how to make coffee. I was interning at a morning show in Orlando, Florida, and they told me to make coffee in the break room. I went in, pressed the wrong button. The coffee machine exploded. Everyone got upset with me. And you know what? I'll never forget how to make a good cup of coffee because of my internship experience.
Okay. Lauren Berger blogs about internships at internqueen.com. Her book is called All Work, No Pay. Lauren, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
If you want to see the entire list of federal rules about unpaid internships, check out our website, marketplacemoney.org. Last time I visited the drive-thru at my favorite fast food chain, which I will decline to name, the girl counting my change at the cashier window, she wasn't a girl at all. She was a middle-aged woman. Now, that kind of gig used to be a typical summer job for teenagers. But the jobless rate for teens in this country is hovering around 26% right now. And last year, two-thirds of businesses didn't hire any young people for summer jobs. So what's a high school or a college kid to do? 18-year-old Danielle Johnson of Lancaster, California, is still trying to figure that one out. I met her in Los Angeles outside a job search workshop.
Life for a teenager and getting a good job starting off is kind of hard. It's like a battlefield.
How many of you applied for?
So far, Kaiser, and then I even tried Hot and Ready Pizza. I tried Cinemark.
What's that?
The movie theater. Yeah, so of course, no callback. I even applied for McDonald's.
KFC.
Yeah.
No luck.
No, not really.
Danielle's friend, Demisi Parham, was also in line for the jobs workshop. He's resorted to volunteering.
Yeah, I volunteer a lot. I volunteer at the Los Angeles Cancer Research Center. I also volunteer for my stepfather. He works in plumbing.
Have you had any paid jobs?
No.
So, no experience at a paid job yet. He's already 20. Demisi is convinced what it really takes to get a job nowadays is being connected.
It's all about who you know, because when you go on the internet, you're not a face, you're just a sheet of paper.
So maybe Danielle's battlefield analogy isn't so far-fetched. Not only do these kids have to stand out among hundreds, perhaps thousands, of people applying over the internet, but they're often competing with folks who lost jobs during the recession, who may have years of work experience and real resumes.
We're going to talk about the resume, okay? It is very difficult to get a job without having an awesome resume.
Kelly Sanchez is the instructor at this job search workshop. Sanchez asked the group if they know about scannable resumes. Apparently, they need one. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, Google it. You should. And then they talk etiquette. Don't use an email address with silly nicknames or slang. Clean up your Facebook page. Dress conservatively for interviews. Hide the tattoos. No cleavage. No saggy pants. After all, Sanchez says, those older workers they're up against for the job, they know the rules. And you can be darn sure they'll wear a belt with their pants.
The system is now designed to weed people out. There's so many people looking for work. So the minute that there's a spelling error, you know, they're not prepared. They show up late. They're calling the business, asking for directions. Those sorts of things, you're done. They have to have all of their T's crossed and their I's dotted and to stand out.
But here's the thing. These kids are also under pressure to stand out to colleges. And that can mean spending your summers doing things that help boost your test scores or buff up your academic resume. David Rattray is Senior Vice President of Education and Workforce Development with the L.A. Chamber of Commerce. He gets big employers like Wells Fargo and the grocery chain Ralph's to hire at-risk teens in Los Angeles.
Well, I think we're still suffering from sort of this intense sense that academic excellence is the only ticket to getting into a good college, and that colleges increasingly are starting to deprioritize SAT scores and kind of academic grades only and look more to a well-rounded young person. So they're starting to value work experience more, and students that have gone out and learned a little bit about skills and been productive.
Now, I can imagine a whole lot of parents out there listening to you and thinking, oh, really? Are they de-emphasizing test scores and GPAs? How do you know that?
Well, literally, the University of California and other major universities have said we have either stopped using some of those kind of traditional measures or we have decreased the weight that we put on them.
Okay, stop right there. I mean, does slinging burgers really look as good to colleges as taking one of those unpaid internships we just talked about, or maybe a more noble endeavor like volunteering at the free health clinic?
Yeah, I would even go farther than that. I think the universities are starting to become worried about a young person that seems so narrow in their development, and they're inviting applications from students that are more authentic, that the young person can say, I've developed different dimensions of my personality and my life, and they're actually weighing more toward that than they are toward a student that can just show all these achievements that I've gotten.
By the way, Rattray says he doesn't mean to give the impression that colleges have stopped emphasizing grades, that GPA is still key, kids. So let us know if you think David Rattray is right about all this. And if you know of any great summer jobs for teens, write us at marketplacemoney.org. So you heard that young man, DeMisi, talk about how it's easier to get a summer job when you know somebody, or know somebody who knows somebody, right? Well, that was the case with listener Catherine Hartnett's 15-year-old daughter, Delaney. They both join us now from Portland, Maine. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hi.
So, Delaney, let's start with you. Why did you want to get a summer job in the first place? Hey, you're only 15.
I'm actually getting a car when I turn 16. Uh-huh. That was my brother, so I'll have some gas money and money for a little extra stuff.
Catherine, are you okay with Delaney getting a job instead of, say, going to camp or doing something else this summer?
I am way more than okay with Delaney getting a job. I think it's a sort of rite of passage in our house. People sort of earn the extras that they want to have throughout the year.
Tell us, Delaney, about your job hunt first. We'll get to your job in a minute because you did find one. Tell us about your job hunt.
Well, my brother works at a diner, so I've applied there, but they don't have any openings.
Right.
And I've applied at an ice cream place and a pizza place, but I'm not old enough to do the jobs, or it just hasn't worked out.
So you did find a job. What is it?
I'm going to be a standardized patient.
What is that?
Basically, I pretend or I act like I'm a patient, and medical students basically learn how to talk to me.
Wow, that is a great job. Now, how much does that pay?
I'm going to be getting $15 an hour.
That's pretty good for a 15-year-old, I'd say.
Yeah, it's very good.
Catherine, you did help her get the job through connections, right?
I did. I actually play in a women's field hockey league and happened to mention that we were on the teenage job hunt sort of in passing. It wasn't even a very deliberate, do you know anybody?
Yeah.
And this woman mentioned what she did for a job part-time and that they were going to be looking for some replacement teens to play roles. And I said, wow, that could be a good thing for her to do.
Do you think it was easier for teenagers to get jobs back when you were young?
Well, when I was young, it was the late 70s, and we were, you know, economic times weren't very good back then. I'm not sure if it was all that much easier.
So, Delaney, what are you going to do with the money that you make? You are going to save and for the gas, anything else?
I don't really know yet. Just saving for whatever might catch my interest later, I guess.
Yeah.
College expenses will be catching your interest later.
Aha. Did you hear that, Delaney?
Yes, loud and clear.
Yeah. Catherine Hartnett and Delaney Stokes came to us through the Public Insight Network, and you can become a Marketplace Money source, too. Learn more about the Public Insight Network at marketplacemoney.org. And Delaney, Catherine, I hope you both have a great summer. Thanks.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you.
And that'll do it for Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, when the show comes on, the gloves come off, we're helping people resolve their fights about money.
I'm cheap? You think I'm cheap? How could you say that to me? I can't believe this. How could you say that to me?
You asked me to.
You should have lied.
Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch with Lindsay Foster Thomas and Daryl Perinata. Brendan Willard is our engineer. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace General Manager is J.J. Yore. I'm Sarah Gardner. Have a great weekend.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.